The following audio is from Fathom Church in downtown Littleton, Colorado. More information about Fathom can be found at fathomchurch.org.
If you have your Bibles, and I hope you do, let's open them up to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel 11 is where we're going to be this morning. You can open your own Bible. There are hardback black Bibles under every chair. I would say you can open a phone and tablet, but I think it's better for you to see this in actual writing. So like text, like paper. So those hardback black Bibles, please feel free to open those up. 2 Samuel 11 is on page 262. But we're going to get through this whole chapter this morning. 2 Samuel chapter 11. As you are meeting me there, I moved into my house about almost 6 years ago. And when I moved into my house, there were three apple trees in our yard. Three apple trees. And you might think to yourself, that's awesome. Okay, I love apples. Okay, so that might be your thought. And you would be wrong. Okay, apple trees are awful. All right, just need to know that. They are the worst. Now hear me. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. They're beautiful in the spring when they bud and there's flowers on them. Okay. And they're really cool in the fall when you can pick your own apple and eat that. That is cool. Okay. But they require a lot of care. Apple trees, fruit trees, they require a lot of pruning. They attract a lot of flies. Like fruit trees attract flies. The apples will eventually fall onto your grass and your dogs will eat them incessantly and then vomit apple slop all over the place. I mean, they are way more trouble than they are worth. Apple trees are the worst. Okay, I'm standing by it. So the day that I closed on my house, I cut down three apple trees. Cut down those trees. They were not worth it. And it was some work to cut those things down. Cutting down a tree, getting rid of the stump, that is hard work. But if you know anything about apple trees, you know that every single root of an apple tree produces what's known as a sucker. And a sucker are these little shoots that come up from the roots and from the stump of an apple tree. And so even though I cut down those three apple trees, for the next year, 2, 3, 4 years long, I had to contend with these suckers shooting up all over my yard. So here's what I want to show you. I brought some apple seeds today. Okay. These are apple seeds. I bought these on Amazon. Okay, you can buy apple seeds on Amazon. You can buy anything on Amazon. But I brought some apple seeds with me today, and I want to show you something. This is one little apple seed. This little seed right here. This one seed can produce a tree. An entire tree, the bane of my existence, comes from one little seed. And these trees can produce suckers. Every tree can produce unnamed numbers of suckers, and those suckers can come up, and if you're not careful and you don't deal with those suckers, they can take over the entire world. I guarantee it. The apples are on a mission to take over the world. So here, I need you to hold this apple seed, okay, for me. Don't lose that, okay? That is yours. Hold that for me for this sermon, okay? The whole time. We are in week 10. We are in week 10 of our 2 Samuel sermon series, and today we finally get to the story of David and Bathsheba. And so even if you're not that familiar with the Bible, you probably know those names. You probably have heard of David and Bathsheba, and you know that what we're about to get into is not good. It is not good. And gosh, y'all, we are about to watch King David. Okay, King David, the man after God's own heart, the greatest king in Israel's history, make the biggest mistake of his life. And it stems from an itty bitty seed, a tiny little seed. So I'm calling today's sermon, How to Have an Affair. Not like that. No. This is a warning sermon. You want to know how to ruin your life. You want to know how you could ruin your marriage ruin, your children. You want to know how you can put everything that you love so dearly on the rocks? You want to know how to do that? You want to know how to have an affair? Just follow these three simple steps. And I guarantee you it could happen. I guarantee you it can happen. So let's get into this, okay? This is going to be a good one. 2 Samuel chapter 11. We're going to start in verse 1. Follow along in your text, please. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. Okay, this is the setup. And the writer, all through chapter 11, the writer of this chapter is trying to show us something. Lots of things as we read this. And the writer is trying to show us things in the details here. Here's what you need to note in verse 1. David doesn't go out when kings go out. That's the first thing. It's springtime, the text says. So that means that the winter rains have ceased. The ground is firming up. And it's the time when kings go out to war. Now, kings didn't always accompany their troops out in battle. We've already seen that in David. Sometimes you just send the troops out. But this writer specifically mentions that this is the time when kings do go out. It's the time when kings go out. And the writer wants us to take note that David didn't go. David sent and David stayed. He didn't go. He sent and he stayed. And the writer wants us to know David is in the wrong place. He's not where he is supposed to be. And so, church, you want to know the first way to guarantee? You want to know how you have an affair? You want to know how to have an affair? Here's the first thing. Don't look where you are. Don't look. Don't pay attention to where you are. Just get caught up in whatever is going on. Seed number one is don't look. And I want you to hear me on this one. This is really important. It's far easier to avoid temptation than it is to resist temptation. Far easier. It's far easier to just say, I ain't going there because that's where temptation might lurk, as opposed to getting there, facing it, and then trying to wrestle with, do I succumb to this temptation or not? It's far easier to avoid temptation than it is to resist it. Far easier. So if you want to have an affair, don't look. Don't pay attention to where you are. Don't look around at your surroundings. Don't look, just go through life not paying attention. David sent and David stayed. That's what we see in the text. Here's one of the scholars, a Hebrew scholar named Robert Alter. He points out that in this chapter, there's a verb to send in the Hebrew. The verb to send shows up right here in verse 1. That verb happens 11 times in this chapter. 11 times we see that David sent or David sends. David doesn't even leave his house for this entire chapter. He never leaves home. He goes up on the roof, but he never leaves his domicile. He doesn't leave his house. All he does is send others to do his bidding. And here's the quote that Robert Alter gives. He says this, David, now a sedentary king, has removed himself from the field of action and endowed himself with a dangerous amount of leisure. And I would imagine that for some of us, that's a pretty good description of where we're at. Maybe you've got a dangerous amount of leisure in your life. It's TV. It's that glowing rectangle, your phone, right? It's that incessant streaming and scrolling. It's maybe a hobby. It's something, but you indulge in a dangerous amount of leisure. And I'm just telling you, it's not good for you. Are you looking at where you are? Are you paying attention to what you're actually feeding yourself in all of those things? Because y'all, sin begins really small. It's a seed. It starts there. You ever hear somebody who gets caught in sin say, it all began so innocently? Y'all, it always does. It always begins like that. And so, church, right from verse one, we see that temptation comes and it captures us when we are lazy and not alert. When we're not dialed into where we're supposed to be, when we don't look. Personal sin often begins when we neglect productive activity. Very often, this is how it happens. We are easiest prey for Satan when we're bored, when we're idle. And so hear me, if you don't find a productive pastime, the enemy will send you a destructive one. What do you do with your free time? What do you do when you get off of work, when you're done with class? What are you spending hours of your day, of your week, of your month on? If it's not a productive pastime, I promise you, the enemy will send you something that will destroy you. So David, listen, David has not sinned in verse one. There is no explicit sin in verse one, but he's not looking at where he's at. He's not paying attention. He's not positioning himself to avoid temptation. Instead, he's moving in to proximity to it. And so here it comes, verse two. It happened. Do you love those two words? I mean, look at that again. Verse two. It happened. Do you think the writer's trying to tell us something there? Yeah. He put himself in the position. He didn't go out where kings go out. And so it happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch. Why is he on his couch? I don't know. And was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. Verse three, and David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So just as a point of note, in his laziness, says David's on the couch, it's late afternoon, it's early evening, he's lounging on his couch far longer than he should, but it's there that the temptation shows up. It's when he's lazy, it's when he's inactive that the temptation shows up. Laziness plus opportunity equals a sure failure. Laziness plus opportunity equals a sure failure. It's almost impossible to resist in this moment. And I just wonder how many of us could look back at our past sins and see some of the same formula. I was lazy, not doing what I ought to do, not being where I ought to be, when an opportunity presented itself to me, and one thing led to another. So David is on his couch, he gets up, he goes to the roof, he then sees a very beautiful woman from his rooftop. And he asks his people about this woman, and one of them knew her. Now, this is the writer, one of the commentators pointed this out. This is a unique feature to this story because the one or the servant who tells David who this woman is introduces her by the name of her father and her husband, which is unique. This is not how you would introduce a woman in ancient Hebrew narrative. To use two men to identify one woman is almost unheard of in the text, but it's here because David knew both of those men. Okay? David knew her father, Eliam, because he was one of his soldiers. He was in his army. And then her husband was a man named Uriah the Hittite. And we know who Uriah was. Okay, Uriah, so when David was a fugitive, when he was in the wilderness being hunted down by Saul, a group of his friends voluntarily came around him, and they were known as David's mighty men. And they risked their life for him to save David while he is on the run from the murderous Saul. And one of David's mighty men, we find out, is a man named Uriah the Hittite. So Uriah isn't just any guy. Okay, this is a man to whom David owes his life. This is one of his closest friends. So the question is, why would they introduce Bathsheba with two guys in the title, like in the name? Well, I think the servant is very likely trying to, without overstepping his position in authority in the kingdom, is trying, though, to warn David. He's trying to warn him. David's up on the roof and he's like, oh, who dat, you know? And his servant says, that's Eliam's daughter. You know, you know who I'm talking. It's Eliam's daughter. That's Uriah's wife. Like, take the hint. Like, hint, wink, wink. Like she's off limits, bro. You're the king. I get you're the king, but she is off limits. You know her daddy. You know her husband. He's trying to warn David, I think. That's what I think he's doing there. And I'll use it to make my second point about how to have an affair. Don't listen. Don't listen to warnings. Don't look at where you are. Don't pay attention to where you are. But also, when somebody starts chirping in your ear, when your conscience starts fluttering, when you realize, hey, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, don't listen to that. It's a surefire way to keep down that path. Do you have people in your life who can speak the truth to you, and do you listen to them? Do you listen to them? David has them. He has this guy. He's giving him the out. He's like, hey, you know her. You know daddy. You know husband. They're your buddies. But he doesn't listen. One other thing to note in verse 3, just so you're aware, this is the only time that Bathsheba is named in the entire chapter. It's the only time she's given a name in the entire chapter. The rest of the chapter, she'll be known as the woman or as Uriah's wife. But she is not called Bathsheba again in this chapter. And I think it's because the servant is trying to humanize her to David. He's like, bro, that's Bathsheba. That's Eliam's little girl. That's Uriah's precious wife. Don't look twice, bro. But David only sees a woman. And I don't have time to get into this, but my friends, be careful. Sexual sin dehumanizes people. You don't ever think about who their parents are. You don't ever think about who their loved ones are. You don't ever think about who their children are. It's just a woman. It's just a man. Dehumanizes. And now verses 4 and 5, okay? Every scholar I read mentioned the speed at which now the text moves. Verses 1 through 3 slow down, and verses 4 through 5 speed up unbelievably fast. So notice how quick the action is. The writer is trying to show us something about the rush of events that follow David's rush of passion. Okay, so follow along in verses 4 and 5. Look at these. So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanliness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. He sent, he took, he lay, and she left. Those are very direct verbs. The royal deed of self-indulgence just happens rapidly. So fast that he never had time to even think about what he was doing. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18 is a verse on sexual immorality. And Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 6, 18 to flee sexual immorality. To flee, to run. The command that Paul gives to Christian brothers and sisters in this church in Corinth is that they should run from sexual temptation. Now, think about, this happens in the text. Think about Joseph running from Potiphar's wife. Remember this? When she's trying to seduce him and he leaves his coat behind because he is like, I am out of here. I cannot stay here. I'm going to run away. Now, this is why this is a big deal. 1 Corinthians is a big deal because Paul says in another book, in Ephesians chapter 6, he says these words. He says, stand firm against the devil and his schemes. So that's a wild contrast for me. Follow me here. That means that if you leave church today and you drive home and you pull up to your house and the devil himself is standing in your driveway, then Paul's encouragement to you is armor up, full armor of God, because greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And so you take on Satan. In the same breath, though, if you pull up to your house this afternoon from church and you roll up there and it's like your ex-girlfriend from high school's there in a miniskirt, Paul's command is run, run, Forrest, run, right? Flee sexual temptation. You can stand firm against the devil, but don't you mess with sexual temptation. It's my third thing. You want to know how to have an affair? Don't leave. Don't leave. Just stick around. Don't look. Don't look, right? Don't look around where you're at. Don't listen. Don't heed the warnings of people, of your conscience. And then when you got the opportunity to run, don't leave. It's a surefire way to have an affair. It's a three-step, I mean, I don't give like three steps to, you know, the best life ever, but I'll give you three steps to ruin your life, and that's it, right there. Most of us, when we are confronted with sexual temptation, we don't flee. We flirt. We don't run away. We stay and we engage and we just think, oh, it's just fun right now. Every single time that you have sinned sexually, it's because that when we're tempted, we have an opportunity to leave. And instead of fleeing, we flirted. Every single time. I mean, I was a youth pastor for almost 15 years. I got this question hundreds of times when I was a youth pastor. Hundreds of times. Where's the line? Where's the line where I can go to with my boyfriend or my girlfriend? Every youth in my entire life has asked me that question. Where's the line? But listen, when you ask the question, where's the line? It inevitably leads you to ask the next question, which is how close to the line can I get without crossing it? How close to the line can I get before it's sin, Pastor? And then when you start asking that question, then the next question is, well, how far over the line? How far over the line can I get and still manage the consequences? How far over can I hang and it not devastate my life? And once you've asked that question, you will find yourself asking the question, how did I get here? How did I get to this spot? And church, that's the three simple steps to have an affair. You wanna know how to have an affair? It's that simple. Don't look where you are. Don't listen to the warnings and don't leave that temptation. And I can almost guarantee you, take it from 20 plus years of ministry experience, I can almost guarantee you that's where it's gonna lead. Almost guarantee it. So I spent a lot of time on those first few verses. We're gonna do the rest of this chapter. I promise we'll get through it. But one more thing before we move on. People wanna argue about the motives of Bathsheba. They do, they wanna argue about this. And so I just give you a couple of options here. People say things like, well, Bathsheba shouldn't have been bathing out in the open on the roof. What is she doing on the roof? And I just wanna point you back to the text. That's not what it said. It didn't say she was on the roof, it said he was on the roof. And I wonder if you wanna wager with me what the highest structure in ancient Israel was in Jerusalem. Yeah, it's the palace, okay? There's no temple at this point. It's his palace made of cedar wood. We read about that a few chapters ago. Remember the beautiful new palace that he just built? It's the tallest point in the city. It's the high point. David is being portrayed here as a peeping Tom. He's looking down upon other residents. And it's not like she's in a bubble bath seducing him. She is bathing for ritual purification after her time of month, after her cycle. It's not like a scrub-a-dub-dub in the tub kind of thing. You follow me? It's a ritual bathing exercise. Well, some people will then also say, well, the text says that she came to him. And it does say that, but you need to know something of the power dynamics at work here. You really do. He's the king. He's the king. He sent for her. He didn't even say why. And it doesn't even really matter, because when the king calls in a sovereign kingdom, you come. When the king calls you, you come. And then scholars absolutely point out that there's not one word said about Bathsheba's emotions or intentions in this entire passage. We are given nothing. And now remember, the writer is trying to show us something. And also remember, the Bible cannot mean for us what it did not mean to them. So stop trying to read other things onto this. It cannot mean, the writer wants you laser focused on David in this encounter. That's the point. David is the point of this text. Now, not all women are victims in the Bible. I just need you to know that, okay? We saw this with Potiphar's wife. We saw this with Lot's daughters. We even see this with one of David's previous wives, a gal named Abigail, back in 1 Samuel 25, where she's a bit conniving. But in this story, I just need you to know, in this story, Bathsheba and Uriah are meant to be seen as victims. In this story, they are the victims of David's choices and David's sins. I think the most telling verse is in verse 4, the words in verse 4 where it says, he took her. She's property. She's an object. And he took her. Because, listen, there are Old Testament words for sex. He knew her. That's not what it said. He took her. So I really wish that were the end of the story, because it's bad enough. Like, the first five verses are bad enough, but y'all, sin never happens in a vacuum. It's just a seed. All we've seen are seeds so far. Let's see what they grow into. And one other thing, did you notice that everything that's happened up to this point is something that David could have controlled? Everything was in his control. You can control where you are. You can control if you listen and heed the warnings of others. You can control if you leave when something is presented to you. Like, you can control those things. Those are the things that are in our control. And I think it's really important to know this for the rest of the text. You get to control your inputs, but you don't get to control the outcomes. You can control all of the inputs. These are all things that are in his control, and everything else from here on out is way outside of his control. It's outside of his control. We have a ton of control over the seeds that we plant in our lives, but we have almost no control over what they grow into. So now he has chosen to sow some real shady seeds in his dirt. The first outcome, we already read it in verse 5, I'm pregnant. Whoops. But now he's going to try to control things further. Okay, so we're going to pick up speed. Let's go, verse 6. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Verse 8, then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. So what we see here is David's plan begin to unhatch on how he's going to cover over this mess that he's created, okay? He brings Uriah back from the front lines under the guise of getting information. How's Joab? How are the men? How's the battle? How are things going? And once he's heard enough to make the trip plausible, then he tells Uriah, hey, go home, man, and wash your feet, which is an ancient Hebrew euphemism for go home and sleep with your wife. Go home and have sex with your wife. And what's implied is, Uriah, you can go home, man. Thanks for coming. You're a good friend. It's time for you to go be with your wife. You've earned it. In fact, I'm going to send you a present. It says I'm going to send him a present with like meat and wine, you know, good food, good drink. Go enjoy yourself, my friend. Thank you for the news. It's shower, supper, sex. That's the plan. That's the plan. He's trying to get Uriah to sleep with Bathsheba so that the pregnancy can be explained by that encounter. That's what he's trying to do. But remember, you can control inputs. You can't control outcomes. So verse 9. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his Lord and did not go down to his house. And that's a shocking twist. Like if you're David, you're thinking, wait a minute, hold on a second. Your wife is just down the street. I can see into your house. Not that I've ever done that, okay? But like I can see into your property. What are you doing? Why are you sleeping here at the palace with the servants? Like, what are you doing, man? It's a shocking twist. Verse 11. And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths or tents. And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." Uriah essentially says, never. Not on my honor. I would never indulge myself like this while my men are at war. By the way, that's exactly what David should have said. That's exactly what he should have said when he saw the woman from the rooftop. He should have said, never on my honor would I ever do that. But this is going to bother David now. This is going to bother David because when you are in sin, there's nothing more annoying and unnerving than the integrity of others. So it's going to annoy him. Look at what happens, verse 12. Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord, but he did not go down to his house. Gosh, David even tries to get Uriah drunk. He succeeds. He tries to lower his inhibitions with alcohol, but it doesn't work. And so David is at a crossroads. He has a decision to make. Will he confess? The cover-up plan is not going as he wants it to. The outcomes are out of his control, and it's not working. So surely now's the time to confess. Now's the time to come clean. James chapter 1, verse 14 and 15 says this. I'll put this up here. "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death." Church, I need you to hear this. When sin is concealed, sin will compound. When you think you've got that secret sin locked tight enough up that no one will find it, it'll grow. Verse 14. "So in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, 'Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die.' And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died." So now Joab's in on this. The commander of his army is in on this, and he's going to have to fudge his military strategy to cover up David's sin. And yes, Uriah is killed, but did you see that more of David's valiant men are killed as well? It's not just Uriah. It's not one murder. It's many murders, all as a result of David trying to cover it up. When sin is concealed, sin will compound. It will compound. The seed has grown. And it's grown. And it's grown. Into, doesn't seem like one apple tree, but a whole grove of those trees. Suckers showing up all over David's life. Now, we're going to skip verses 18 through 25. They're very interesting, but I don't have time. They cover Joab relaying the information back to David, informing him that Uriah died. So it's interesting. Read that on your own time. But we're going to skip to the very end and look at verse 26. So verse 26 of chapter 11. When the wife of Uriah, nope, she has no name. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. Now, for David to take her as a wife was actually a common practice in this time. It's an act of nobility because he has become her kinsman redeemer. If you remember the book of Ruth, this is the same idea. He is now marrying the widow of a fallen soldier, honoring her husband's memory. And so in public, David becomes the hero of this story. He becomes the hero of the story, and everyone just assumes she got pregnant on their honeymoon, and they all live happily ever after. I want you to see at the end of chapter 11 that David thinks he got away with it. David thinks he got away with the whole thing. But I didn't read the very last sentence of chapter 27. The very end of 27 says this: but the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Two more things before I close up. First, if you have ever been a victim of sexual abuse or have been sinned against sexually, I want you to see that last sentence. I want you to see that God sees. The thing displeased the Lord. David thinks he got away with it. And pardon my language, the Lord's pissed. You're going to see it next week. Second thing, while David thinks he may have gotten away with this heinous series of events, God is first mentioned in verse 27. He has not been mentioned all through the chapter, and the first time that he's mentioned is the time we realize that justice is coming. We're gonna have to wait to see how that justice plays out till next week, but church, I just wanna end like this. It all starts with a seed. Did you see the progression in this chapter? A small, unassuming, innocent seed. He just doesn't go to war when he should. But then it grew. And it grew and it grew. Did you see the progression? He covets, then he commits adultery, then he lies about it, and then finally he murders to cover it up. That's like half the Ten Commandments. And this is the great lie with sin. It's especially sexual sin, but with all sin, we think that we're just gonna satisfy an urge. But that's the great lie. Sin is never satisfied. Okay, it only grows more hungry the more you feed it. So I wrestled with what do we take away from this horrible chapter? Like, what's the application for us? And there's a lot, okay, but I'm going to leave it like this morning. The seeds of the most terrible atrocities, the capability of the worst possible sins, are present in every human heart. Give me that seed back. The seeds of every atrocity are already in your hand. They're already in your heart. You have them already. Even the very best of people. David is the man after God's own heart. You think you're better than him? He wrote the Psalms. Anybody? the seeds of the very most atrocious, most heinous sins reside in the heart of every human being, even those who are saved by God. Those seeds right now, they exist in your heart. That's what I think this chapter is teaching. And if you begin to say, oh, but I could never. Oh, but I could never. Then you've taken the first step towards it. You've taken the first dangerous step towards falling. Don't ever be surprised what you're capable of. So this apple seed that you were holding all sermon. Hey, good job not losing it. I'm proud of you. I need it for second service. Here's what I know. Here's what I know about apple seeds, okay? Apple seeds contain a compound that if you crush this thing up and consume it with your stomach acid, it can produce a chemical called hydrogen cyanide. So cyanide literally exists in every apple seed. That's toxic for humans. So did you realize you were holding in your hand something that could kill you? The whole time we were talking, you had a seed in your hand that could actually kill you. Now, don't worry, I wouldn't do that to you because I love you. And plus, you have to eat, I did the math, you have to eat anywhere between 83 and 500 apple seeds to get enough cyanide to produce a lethal dose and to kill you. So 83 to 500, that's a big spectrum. That's a big spectrum. But I did some more math, okay? So here's what you need to know. The average apple produces 5 to 10 seeds. And that means that you only need to eat 17 apples at minimum or 100 apples at maximum to kill you. And an average apple tree produces 1,500 apples per season. So I did that math, okay? And that means that one tree could kill between 88 and 150 people. My trees, the three trees that I cut down in my yard, could wipe out this whole church. All from the seed. All from a seed. And we think that one seed doesn't matter. Because it doesn't. And we think that maybe another doesn't matter. Because it doesn't. You waiting to see if I'm gonna fall over? Guys, the seeds of compromise are present inside you long before the harvest of destruction. 88 seeds and I might keel over. 500 seeds and it's a sure thing. Every time we lust, every time we look at pornography, every time we flirt instead of flee, it's a seed. How many can you handle before things start blowing up in your life? And you will not be able to control what those seeds become if they find the right soil. So I'm going to end with the quote that I quote in like every sermon on sin. It's from the Puritan John Owen, who says this: you must be killing sin or sin will be killing you. It's far easier to crush a seed than to take down an entire apple tree. Although apparently the wind did a great job with that yesterday. You've already planted that seed? Go home and dig it up. What's hiding under your mattress? What's hiding in your browser history? What's hiding on your text messages? Dig those seeds up before they start growing. Has it already started to sprout? You got some saplings? Rip those things out of the ground, roots and all. You don't want them in your yard. They'll grow into trees that will bring forth fruit that is death. Kill the sin or it'll kill you. And we're gonna see the consequences and the horrific aftermath of David's sin next week. Let's pray. Lord, what a horrible chapter. A terrible, terrible chapter. Lord, we thought we had a king who we could trust. He's not Saul. Like, we thought we were done with that, and we've been reading for weeks and months and even years in this text, all to come to this, all for it to fall apart for one cheap night of thrills. And so it is with sin. Lord, would you convict our hearts? There are seeds present. Lord, would you give us courage to dig those things up, to crush them before they start growing, to rip them up, root and all, and get them out of our lives, expel them out of our lives that we might be holy. Help us to be courageous and strong and brave enough to deal with these things when they're under our control. They're under our control when they're seeds. But once they take root, they become far more out of control. So I don't know, Lord, I'm imagining, I know some of the people in here, and I know that there's some stuff. Lord, would you help us kill sin today? Help us learn from our father, David, how not to have an affair. So God, we love you. Holy Spirit, convict us deeply and push us to change. We pray these things, Lord, in the name of Jesus and the power of the Spirit, and all God's people said. Amen.